His hay-colored hair with one hand. Definitely, he's hiding something. Something bad. Thora had not considered another possibility, that men in fact did not have the biological capability to ejaculate the contents of their stomach, but rather that the bit of brontosaurus burger had been in Laura's mouth from the beginning, before the blowjob even started, stuck there in the pit where a wisdom tooth used to be, and it was simply Larry's orgasmic bucking that jimmied it loose. In other words, a coincidence, if an unfortunate one. Afterward, she told Larry he was no longer welcome to come in her mouth, and he enthusiastically suggested other places to do his business. Her face, breasts, and butt were the expected targets. Expected because they had both ingested so many hours of internet pornography that they were simply acting out scenes that had become normalized, even banal. That Larry wanted to finish every sex act by splashing onto some part of her seemed like the customary way sex should end, raised as they were on porn's ejaculatory cliches. But then Larry expanded the target zone. He wanted to come on her feet, her back, in her hair, on the bridge of her nose. He wanted her to wear glasses so he could come on her glasses, on her elbows, on that thin part of her wrists. He was remarkably specific. She had no opinion about this, that Larry seemed to have a mental checklist of body parts he wanted to ejaculate onto. No opinion except that occasionally this made her feel like the sexual equivalent of a bingo card. "What's Professor Anderson hiding?" Larry said. "What's on his computer?" "Something embarrassing, maybe even criminal." "Seriously?" "Definitely," Laura said, and she was maybe about 80% sure this was true. Because who didn't have something embarrassing on their computer? A dubious downloaded image, something questionable in the browser history? The odds were in her favor.
"I'm only supposed to log into someone's computer if they ask me for help," Larry said. "I can't go snooping around."
"You can say you were doing routine maintenance." She took another step toward him so that she emerged from behind the towel. She couldn't be sure what was going on down there, focused as she was on Larry, but judging by his expression, the way he stared at her, she figured she was now mostly exposed from the waist down.
"Think about it," Laura said. "If you find something that proves he's not fit to be a teacher, you'd be a hero. My hero."
Larry stared at her.
"Will you do this for me?" she said.
"I'll get in trouble," he said.
"You won't, I promise," she said, taking his head with the other hand, letting go of the towel, which dropped softly to the floor.
She always loved this moment, the change that came over men when they recognized what was about to happen, how fast they clicked over to a new kind of intensity and focus. Larry was already grabbing at her.
"Okay," he said, "I'll do it."
She smiled. At that moment, he would have agreed to anything. It was never this moment that Laura had a problem with, the moment of seduction. The problem was afterward. Men tended to drift away from her in a few weeks. They could not be counted on. She'd had 3 different guys, for example, all friends with benefits type guys, come out as bi-asexual soon after their encounters, meaning they said that they were no longer attracted to either gender equally. Which, she was like, what are the odds? After Larry had finished and left her dorm room and she had wiped the slimy traces of him off her shin bones, which was a first, she returned to Ifeel, hoping that maybe she'd have more clarity now, maybe she'd be able to figure out what to say, what she felt. But no luck. Her emotions seemed as foreign as ever. She decided to activate the autocorrect function on Ifeel. A really excellent little piece of software that took whatever emotion you thought you were feeling and compared it to the millions of entries collected in the Ifeel database. And, in a crowd-surfing, data-mining sort of way, extrapolated which of the 50 standard emotions you were actually feeling. Laura clicked a link. A text field opened up and she began typing. "I feel like I don't deserve to fail my class just because I cheated on some dumb assignment, but also I know I probably shouldn't be cheating so much in all of my classes, because someday I'll have to go out and get a job and have knowledge in my field or whatever, frowny face. But at this point, I actually have to cheat because I've cheated so much in the past that I usually have no idea what's going on in any of my classes, confused face. So if I stopped cheating, I would get really bad grades and maybe even fail out of school. So it seems to me, if I'm going to fail either way, I might as well cheat and get the grades I need to become the powerful business professional my mother so desperately wants me to be. So I have to prevent this meeting with the professor, and I've thought about it a lot, and I've realized that the university won't require the professor to come to this meeting if the professor is not an employee of the university. So maybe the way forward is to totally discredit the professor and get him fired and ruin his life, which makes me feel a little guilty and also angry that the school has boxed me in this way and essentially forced me to do something I will feel sort of remorseful about later, all because I plagiarized one stupid paper. Ah! She pressed enter, and the iFeel app processed this for a moment before the autocorrect displayed the answer. Do you mean bad? Sure, that must be what she meant. She posted it right away. I feel bad. And seconds later, the text messages poured in. Cheer up, girl, smiley face. Don't feel bad. You're great. Love ya. You're the best. And so on. Dozens of them from friends and admirers, boyfriends and lovers, colleagues and acquaintances. And while they did not know the reason she felt bad, it was surprisingly easy to pretend they did, that they knew about the plan, and so each message had the effect of stealing her resolve. This is what she had to do. She thought about her future, her mother, everything that was at stake, and she knew she was right. She would go through with the plan. The professor had it coming. He was asking for it. He wouldn't know what hit him. 3. They met at one of the chain restaurants near Henry's suburban office park, the kind of place erected right off the highway, on a terrifyingly busy one-way access road. The route here tended to confuse one's GPS device or map app, as it required a series of awkward and counterintuitive U-turns to navigate the various viaducts and on-ramps and clover leaves made necessary by the nearby 14-lane expressway. Inside, the music was happy top 40 sing-along stuff, the floors industrially carpeted and within the orbits of children in high chairs, chummed with food globs and milk slicks and crayons and damp little twisted flecks of napkin. Families stood in the front vestibule awaiting their tables, staring at the round plastic puck the hostess gave them, a device that contained some kind of inner motor and light apparatus that would blink and agitate when their table was free. Henry and Samuel sat in a booth holding menus, large laminated menus, dynamically colored and complexly subdivided, roughly the size of the Ten Commandments in that one movie about the Ten Commandments. The food was pretty standard chain restaurant fare, burgers, steaks, sandwiches, salads, a list of inventive appetizers with names involving whimsical adjectives, e.g. sizzlin'. What allegedly set this particular restaurant chain apart from others was that it did something weird with an onion. Cut it and fried it in such a way that the onion unfurled itself and resembled, on the plate, a kind of desiccated, many-fingered claw. There was a rewards club one could join to earn points for the eating of such things. Their table was cluttered with the several appetizers Henry had already purchased with his company's credit card. They were here doing field research, as Henry called it. They sampled the menu and discussed which items had frozen meal potential. Golden fried cheddar bites, yes. Seared ahi tuna, probably not. Henry noted all this on his laptop. They were digging into a plate of miso-glazed chicken skewers when Henry finally asked about the topic he was eager to discuss but trying hard to seem indifferent about. "Oh, by the way, how's it going with your mother?" he said in his dismissive way while sawing at a chicken chunk with a fork. "Not great," Samuel said. "Today I spent the whole afternoon at the UIC library, going through the archive, looking at everything they had from 1968. Yearbooks, newspapers, hoping to find something about Mom." "And?" "Zilch." "Well, she wasn't in college very long," Henry said. Maybe a month. I'm not surprised you can't find anything. I don't know what else to do. When you saw her, at her apartment, did she seem, I don't know, happy? Not really. More like quiet and guarded, with a hint of hopeless resignation. That sounds familiar. Maybe I should go see her again, Samuel said. Drop by sometime when her lawyer's not there. That is a terrible idea, Henry said. Why? For one, she doesn't deserve it. She has given you nothing but problems all your life. And two, the crime. It's way too dangerous. Oh, come on. Seriously, what's the address again? Samuel told him and watched as his father typed this into his laptop. It says here, Henry said, staring at his screen, there have been 61 crimes in that neighborhood. Dad, 61! In the last month alone, simple assault, simple battery, forcible entry, vandalism, motor vehicle theft, burglary, another simple assault, criminal trespass, theft, another simple assault, on the sidewalk for Pete's sake. I've been there already, it's fine. On the sidewalk in the middle of the day! Broad daylight, guy just hits you with a crowbar and takes your wallet and leaves you for dead. I'm sure that won't happen. That did happen. That happened yesterday. I mean, it won't happen to me. Attempted theft. Here's a weapons violation. Found person, which I think is a goddamn kidnapping. Dad, listen. Simple assault on the bus. Aggravated battery. Okay, fine. I'll be careful. Whatever you want. Whatever I want. Great. Then don't go. Don't go at all. Stay home. Dad, let her fend for herself. Let her rot. But I need her. You do not. It's not like we're going to start spending Christmases together. I only need her story. I'm going to be sued by my publisher if I don't figure it out. This is a very bad idea. You know what my alternative is? Declaring bankruptcy and moving to Jakarta. That's my choice. Why Jakarta? It's just an example. The point is, I need to get Mom talking. Henry shrugged and chewed his chicken and made notes on his laptop. You see the Cubs game last night? He said, still staring at his screen. I've been a little distracted lately, Samuel said. Henry said, nodding. Good game. This was how they usually related to each other, through sports. It was the topic they fled to whenever conversation lulled or became dangerously personal or sad. After Faye left, Samuel and his father rarely talked about her. They grieved independent of each other. Mostly what they talked about were the Cubs. After she left, both of them found within themselves a sudden and surprisingly powerful and devotional, all-consuming love for the Chicago Cubs. Down came the framed reproductions of incomprehensible works of modern art from Samuel's bedroom walls. Down came the nonsensical poetry broadsides hung there by his mother, and up went posters of Brian Sandberg and Andre Dawson and Cubs pennants. Broadcasts on WGN weekday afternoons, Samuel literally praying to God, on his knees on the couch looking up to the ceiling, praying and crossing his fingers while actually making deals with God in exchange for one home run, one late-inning victory, one winning season. Occasionally, they took trips into Chicago for Cubs games, always during the day, always preceded by an elaborate ritual where Henry packed the car with enough supplies to get them through any roadside catastrophe. He packed extra jugs of water for drinking or radiator malfunction, spare tires, sometimes two, flares, emergency hand crank CB radio, walking maps of Wrigleyville on which he'd written notes from previous trips, where he'd found parking spots, where he'd encountered beggars or drug dealers. Particularly rough-seeming neighborhoods he etched out completely. He brought a fake wallet in case of mugging. When they crossed the boundary into Chicago and the traffic congealed around them and the neighborhood started to change, he said, "Doors locked?" And Samuel jiggled the handle and said, "Check." "Eyes peeled?" "Check." And together they remained vigilant and watchful for crime until returning home again. Henry had never worried like this before, but after Faye disappeared, he became preoccupied with disasters and muggings. The loss of his wife had convinced him that even more loss was imminent and near. "I wonder what happened to her," Samuel said, "in Chicago, in college. What made her leave so quickly?" "No idea. She never talked about it."
"Didn't you ask?"
"I was so happy she came back, I didn't want to jinx it. Don't look a gift horse in the mouth, you know? I let the matter drop. I thought I was being very modern and compassionate." "I have to find out what happened to her."
Hey, I need your opinion. We're launching a new line. Which logo do you prefer?
Henry slid two glossy pieces of paper across the table. One said, Farm Fresh Frozens. The other, Farm Fresh Freezens.
I'm glad you're so concerned about your son's well-being, Samuel said.
Seriously, which do you like better?
I'm glad my personal crisis is so very important to you.
Stop being dramatic. Pick a logo.
Samuel studied them for a moment. I guess I'd vote Frozens. When in doubt, spell words correctly.
That's what I said, but the advertising folks said Freezens made the product seem funner. That's the word they actually used. Funner.
Of course, I'd also argue that Frozens isn't a proper word either, Samuel said. More like a word that is not a noun conscripted to dress like one.
My son, the English professor.
Which I guess there's some precedent for. Take the tuna melt or the corn pop.
The advertising folks do that kind of thing all the time. They tell me that 30 years ago you could get away with saying something simple and declarative. Tastes great. Be happy. But consumers these days are way more sophisticated, so you have to get tricky with the language. Taste the great. Find your happy.
I have a question, Samuel said. How can something be both farm fresh and frozen?
That's something that way fewer people stop and think about than you would expect.
Once it's frozen, isn't it, by definition, no longer farm fresh?
It's a trigger word. When they want to advertise to hipster foodies, they use farm fresh, or maybe artisanal or local. For millennials, they use vintage. For women, they use skinny. And don't even get me started on the quote-unquote farm, where all this farm fresh stuff comes from. I'm from Iowa. I know farms. That place is not a farm.
Samuel's phone dinged with a new text message. He made a reflexive move to his pocket, then stopped and folded his hands on the table. He and Henry stared at each other for a moment.
You gonna get that?
Henry said. No, Samuel said. We're talking.
Mighty big of you.
We're talking about your work.
Not really talking, more like you're listening to me complain about it again.
How much longer till retirement?
Ah, too long. But I'm counting the days, and when I finally do leave, no one will be happier than those advertising folks. You should have seen the fuss I made about spelling jalapeno poppers with a Z, or mozzarella sticks with an X. Poppers. Sticks. No thank you.
Samuel remembered how happy his father was the day he got this job and moved the family to Streamwood. Their final exodus from crowded apartment buildings to the expansively grassy and well-spaced houses of Oakdale Lane. For the first time, they had a yard, a lawn. Henry wanted to get a dog. They had a washer and dryer inside the house. No more walking to the laundromat on Sunday afternoons. No more carrying groceries 5 blocks. No more random car vandalism. No more listening to the couple fighting in the apartment upstairs or the baby wailing from below. Henry was ecstatic. But Faye seemed a little lost. Maybe there'd been a struggle between them. She'd wanted to live in a city. He'd wanted to move to the suburbs. Who knows how such things are resolved? There were other, more interesting lives that parents keep hidden from their children. Samuel only knew that his mother had lost the struggle, and she sneered at all the symbols of her defeat. Their big tan garage door, their patio deck, their bourgeois barbecue grill, their long secluded block brimming with happy, safe, bechildrened white people. Henry must have thought he had it all figured out. A good job, a family, a nice house in the suburbs. It was everything he'd always wanted, and so it was a terrible and maybe even shattering blow when it all fell apart. First when his wife abandoned him, then when his job did too. That would have been in 2003, after more than 20 years working there, when Henry was maybe 18 months from a comfortable early retirement, close enough that he was already making plans to travel and take up new hobbies, when his company filed for bankruptcy. This even though the company had issued to its employees an all-is-well memo not 2 days before declaring bankruptcy, this memo saying that rumors of bankruptcy were overblown and to hold on to your stock or even buy more, since it was so undervalued at that moment, which Henry did, though it was later revealed the CEO was at that very moment secretly dumping all his shares. Henry's retirement was tied up completely in the now worthless company stock. and when the company came out of bankruptcy and issued new stock, they offered it only to the board of directors and big-time Wall Street investors. So Henry was left with nothing. The nest egg he'd spent so long amassing evaporated in a single day. That day, as the realization settled over him that his retirement would have to be pushed back 10 or maybe even 15 years, Henry had the same bewildered look he'd had the day that Faye disappeared. He had once again been betrayed by the very thing that was supposed to keep him safe. Now he just seemed cynical and wary, the kind of person who no longer believed in anyone's promises. "The average American eats 6 frozen meals a month, Henry said. "My job is to get that to 7. That's what I'm tirelessly working for, sometimes even on weekends." "Doesn't sound like your heart's really in it." "The problem is that nobody in the office takes the long view. They're all focused on the next quarterly statement, the next earnings report. They haven't seen what I've seen."
"Which is?"
"That whenever we identify some new market niche, all we do in the long run is dismantle it. This is like our guiding principle, our original philosophy. In the 1950s, Swanson saw that families ate meals together and wanted to get into that market. So they invented the TV dinner, which made families realize they didn't have to eat meals together. Selling the family dinner made the family dinner go extinct, and we've been pulverizing the market ever since."
Samuel's phone dinged again, another new text message.
"For Christ's sake," Henry said, "you young people on your phones, just look at it."
"Sorry," Samuel said as he checked the message. It was from Ponich. It said,
"OMG, found woman in photo."
"Sorry, one second," Samuel said to his father while typing a reply. "What woman? What photo?"
"Photo of your mom from the 60s. I found woman in that pic."
"For real?"
"Come to Jezebel's right now, I'll tell you everything." "It's like I'm at work trying to have a conversation with one of our interns," Henry said. "Your head's in 2 places at once, not paying quality attention to anything. I don't care if that makes me sound old."
"Sorry, Dad, I gotta run."
"You can't sit down for 10 minutes without interruption, always so busy."
"Thanks for dinner. I'll call you soon."
And Samuel raced south to the suburb where Ponage lived and parked under the purple lights of Jezebel's and hurried inside, where he found his elf-skate buddy at the bar watching TV, a popular Food Channel show about extreme eating.
"You found the woman in the photo?" Samuel said as he sat down.
"Yes, her name is Alice, and she lives in Indiana, way out in the boonies."
He gave Samuel a photograph, pulled from the internet and printed on copy paper. A woman at the beach on a sunny day, smiling at the camera, wearing hiking boots and cargo pants and a big green floppy hat and a t-shirt that said, "Happy Camper."
"This is really her?" Samuel said. "Definitely. She was sitting behind your mom when that photo was taken at the protest in 1968. She told me herself."
"Amazing," Samuel said.
"Best part, she and your mom were neighbors, like in the dorm, at school."
"And she'll talk to me?"
"I already set it up. She's expecting you tomorrow."
Ponage gave him the printout of a short email correspondence, as well as Alice's address and a map to her house. "How did you find her?"
"I had some time on patch day. No big whoop."
He looked again at the TV.
"Oh, check it out. Do you really think he'll be able to eat that whole thing?"
"I vote yes."
He was talking about the TV show's host, a man known for his ability to eat ridiculous quantities of food without passing out or vomiting. His name was famously etched onto Hall of Fame plaques in dozens of American restaurants where he overcame some food object. A 72-ounce porterhouse steak, an extra-extra-large pizza burger, a burrito weighing more than most newborn babies. His face was puffy in the way of someone who, all over his body, had a quarter inch of extra muchness. Right now, the host gave colorful commentary as a chef in what appeared to be a greasy spoon diner prepared hash browns on a large, discolored griddle, a potato mound he shaped into a square roughly the size of a chessboard. On top of the hash browns, the chef piled 2 handfuls of crumbled sausage, 4 handfuls of chopped bacon, ground beef, several diced onions, and what appeared to be shredded white cheddar or mozzarella or Monterey Jack cheese,
So much cheese that the meats were now obscured totally under a white, melty mess. In the upper right-hand corner of the screen it said, 9/11 remembered.
I owe you, man, Samuel said. Thank you so much. You need something, just ask.
You're very welcome.
Seriously, is there anything I can do for you?
Nah, it's okay.
Well, if there is, please tell me.
The chef splatted 6 spatula-sized balls of sour cream atop the white cheesy layer and spread them over the big brick of food. He rolled the entire apparatus into a log, the fried potato side facing out, cut it in half, and lifted the 2 halves onto a white serving platter, where they stood vertically. They broke apart in places and oozed steam and thick, creamy, fatty liquid. The dish was called the Twin Towers Gut Buster. The host sat in the restaurant's dining area surrounded by patrons excited to be on television. In front of him were the golden potato meat logs. He asked for a moment of silence. Everyone bowed their heads. Close up on the gut buster leaking its white slime. Then the crowd, perhaps cued by someone off camera, started yelling, "Eat! Eat! Eat! Eat!" as the host picked up a knife and fork and sliced into the gutbuster's outer fried crust and scooped up some of its inner drippy mash and guided it into his mouth. He chewed and looked into the camera plaintively and said,
"That is heavy."
The crowd laughed.
"Bro, I don't think I'm gonna make it."
Cut to commercial.
"Actually," Ponage said, "yes, there is one thing you could do for me."
"Name it."
"I have this book," Ponage said. "Well, more like a book idea. A mystery thriller novel?"
"The psychic detective story. I remember."
"Yeah. I always intended to write that book, but I had to push back the writing because there were all these tasks that needed to be completed before I could begin. You know, my readers would expect me to understand how police operate and how the justice system actually works, and so I would need to shadow a real detective for a while, which means I would need to find a detective and explain how I'm a writer working on a novel about police work, and I need a few nights on the job to get the flavor of real police lingo and procedure, that type of thing."
"Sure."
"You know, research."
"Yes."
"But then, okay, I worry that any detective I send my letter to probably won't believe the writer claims, since I've never published anything ever. A fact that the detective would almost certainly deduce, because detectives know how to find things. So before I can contact a detective, I'll have to publish a few short stories in a few literary journals and maybe win a few little awards to corroborate the writer claim, after which the detective would be more apt to allow me on duty,
I suppose.
Not to mention all the books about ESP and other paranormal psychic phenomena that I'd need to read to achieve the proper verisimilitude. In fact, there are so many things I need to finish before the writing can even begin that I'm having trouble finding motivation."
"Are you trying to ask me something specific?"
"If I had a publisher for my book already lined up, then the detective I contacted would automatically believe that I'm a writer. Plus, it would give me an incentive to actually start writing. Plus, there's the advance money, of course, which could fund renovations I plan to make to my kitchen."
"So you want me to show your book to my publisher?"
"Yeah, if it's not too much trouble."
"No problem. Done."
Ponage smiled and slapped Samuel on the back and turned again to watch the guy on TV, who was now halfway through eating the gut buster, having completely devoured one of the twin logs, the other having lost its internal structural integrity and loosened into a cone of slimy potato rubble. The host looked wearily into the camera with the expression of a staggered and exhausted boxer trying to remain conscious. The chef said he'd created the Twin Towers gut buster a few years back in order to never forget. The host started in on the other log. His fork moved slowly. It visibly shook. A concerned onlooker offered him a glass of water, which he refused. He swallowed the next bite. He looked like he hated himself. Samuel stared at the photograph of Alice. He wondered how the fierce-looking protester of 1968 could become this person, who apparently wore cargo pants and ironic T-shirts and tromped along beaches looking perfectly happy and at ease. How could two people who seem so different inhabit the same body? Did you talk to Alice? Samuel said.
Yep.
What did she seem like? What was your impression of her?
She seemed very interested in mustard.
Mustard.
Yep.
Is that slang?
Nope. I mean that literally, Ponage said. She's super interested in mustard.
I don't understand.
Neither did I.
The man on TV, meanwhile, was down to his last few bites. He was exhausted and miserable. His forehead rested on the table and his arms splayed out, and if it weren't for his heavy breathing and visible sweating, it would seem like he was dead. The crowd was ecstatic that he'd almost consumed the entire dish. The chef said no one had ever been this close before. The crowd chanted, USA! USA! As the host held the final bite, trembling, on his fork, aloft. 4. Alice knelt on the soft, spongy ground of the forest behind her house. She clutched a small tuft of mustard plant and pulled, not too hard and not straight up, but rather gently and twistingly, a torsion that freed the roots from the sandy soil without breaking them. This was what she did most days. She roamed the woods of the Indiana dunes, absolving them of their mustard. Samuel stood about 20 paces away, watching her. He was on the narrow gravel path that cut through the woods and connected Alice's cabin with her distant garage. The path was maybe a quarter mile long, up and down a hill. His cresting the hill had set her dogs to barking. "The problem," Alice said, "is the seeds. Garlic mustard seeds can linger for years." It was a one-woman crusade she waged in the dunes along Lake Michigan's southern shore. This certain exotic mustard had found its way into Indiana forests from its native home in Europe, then proceeded to annihilate the local flowers, shrubs, trees. If she weren't here to beat it back, the stuff would take over in just a few summers. Yesterday, she'd been reading one of the Chicago-area invasive species online discussion boards that she moderates, her job being to tell people when they were posting in the wrong area and move their misplaced threads to different discussion boards. She kept everything nice and tidy. She engaged in a sort of pruning that mimicked in a digital way what she did most days in these woods, ripping out things that didn't belong. And since most websites were bombarded with an unthinkable amount of spam, mostly advertisements for male enhancement pills or pornography or who knows what because it's in Cyrillic, even the smallest and most niche sites needed a moderator to vigorously patrol the boards and delete unwanted posts and ads and spam, or else the whole thing choked with senseless data. Most of Alice's time not spent with mustard or her dogs or her partner was spent like this, beating back the advancing chaos, trying to achieve enlightenment order in the face of 21st century madness. She was at her laptop looking in on her invasive species discussion forum and saw that someone named Axeman had posted a thread titled, "Do you know the woman in this photo?" Which seemed definitely like spam because of its unnecessary use of all caps words and because it certainly did not have anything to do with that specific board's ostensible topic, which was honeysuckle, Amour, Morrows, Bells, Standish, and Tartarian. So she was about to move the post to the Odds and Ends forum and scold Axeman for putting it in the wrong place when she clicked on the image in question and saw, incredibly, herself. A photo taken in 1968 at the big protest in Chicago that year. There she was, in her old sunglasses, in her army fatigues, staring at the camera. God damn, she was such a badass. She was in the park in a field of student revelry. Thousands of protesters. Behind her were flags and signs and outlines of old Chicago buildings on the horizon. Faye sitting in front of her. She could hardly believe what she was seeing. She contacted Axeman, who sent her to a strange guy named Ponage, who sent her to Samuel, who came to visit the very next day. He stood several paces away from her, far from this patch of leafy shrub that to the uninitiated looked in no way special but was, in fact, garlic mustard. Each twig on a garlic mustard plant contained dozens of seeds, which wedged in shoe soles and inside socks and on the cuffs of jeans, and were then spread by walking. Samuel was not allowed anywhere near it. Alice wore large plastic boots up to her knees that seemed appropriate for swamps or bogs. She carried black plastic bags that she carefully wrapped around each mustard plant to catch the seeds that dropped as she jostled it out of the ground. Every plant had hundreds of seeds, and not one of them could be allowed to escape. The way she held these bags when they were full of mustard plants, carefully and at a small distance away from her, looked like how one might carry a bag that contained the body of a dead cat.
"How did you get involved with this?" Samuel asked.
"With mustard, I mean."
"When I moved out here," she said, "it was killing all the native plants."
Alice's cabin overlooked a small dune at the edge of Lake Michigan, the closest thing you could get to a beach house in Indiana. She bought the house for next to nothing in 1986, back when the lake was at a record height. The water was a few feet from the porch. If the lake had kept rising, the house would have been washed away. "Buying the house was a gamble," Alice said, "but an educated one."
"Based on what?"
"Climate change," she said.
"Hotter, drier summers. More droughts, less rain. Less ice in the winter, more evaporation. If the climate scientists were right, the lake would have to recede. So I found myself rooting for global warming."
"That must have felt, I don't know, complicated?"
"Every time I was stuck in traffic, I imagined the carbon from all the cars filling the air and saving my house. It was perverse." Eventually, the lake did recede. Now she had a nice big beach where the water used to be. She'd purchased the place for $10,000. It was now worth millions. "I moved out here with my partner," she said. "It was the 80s. We were sick of lying about our relationship. We were fed up telling our neighbors we were roommates, that she was my good friend. We wanted our privacy."
"Where's your partner now?"
"She's away on business this week. It's just me and the dogs. Three of them, rescue dogs. They are not allowed in the woods since their paws would pick up mustard seeds."
"Of course."
Alice's white hair was pulled back in a ponytail. She wore blue jeans under her giant rubber waders, a simple clean white t-shirt. She had that naturalist's lack of attention to outward appearances, an indifference toward things like cosmetics and grooming that read not as apathy but rather as transcendence.
"How's your mother?"
Alice said.
"Indicted."
"But other than that?"
"Other than that, I have no idea. She won't talk to me."
Alice thought about that quiet young girl she used to know, and she regretted that Faye never overcame what tortured her. But such was the way with people. They loved the things that made them miserable. She'd seen it so many times among her movement friends after the movement splintered and grew ugly and dangerous. They were miserable all the time, and the misery seemed to feed them and nourish them. Not the misery itself, but its familiarity. Its constancy.
"I wish I could help," Alice said, "but I don't think I have much for you."
"I'm trying to understand what happened," Samuel said. "My mother kept everything about Chicago a secret. You're the first person I've met who knew her there."
"I wonder why she never talked about it."
"I was hoping you could tell me. Something happened to her there. Something important." Of course he was right, but Alice wouldn't say so.
"What's to tell?" she said, trying to act aloof. "She went to school for a month and left. College wasn't for her. It's a pretty common story."
"Then why would she keep it a secret?"
"Maybe she was embarrassed."
"No, there's more to it than that." "She was a troubled soul when I knew her," Alice said. "Small-town girl, smart, but also a little clueless. Quiet. She read a lot. Ambitious and driven in a way that probably meant she had big-time daddy issues."
"What do you mean?"
"I'll bet she had a dad who was always disappointed in her, you know? So her anxiety about being disappointing to her father was swapped out for a drive to be special to everyone. Psychoanalysts would call this replacement. The child learns what is wanted of her. Am I right about that?"
"Maybe."
"At any rate, she left Chicago right after the protests. I never even got to say goodbye, just all of a sudden gone."
"Yeah, she's pretty good at that."
"Where did you get the photo?"
"It was on the news. I don't watch the news."
"Do you remember who took it?" he said.
"That whole week is a big blur. Everything kind of merges with everything else. I can't really remember one day from the next. Anyway, no, I don't remember who took it. In the photo, it looks like she's leaning against someone."
That would probably have been Sebastian. Who's Sebastian? He was the editor of an underground newspaper, the Chicago Free Voice. Your mother was attracted to him, and he was attracted to anyone who paid attention to him. It wasn't a good match. What happened to him? No idea. That was a long time ago. I left the movement in 1968, right after that protest. Afterward, I didn't keep track of anyone. The mustard plants Alice pulled were about a foot tall, with green heart-shaped leaves and small white flowers. To the untrained eye, they looked like any other ground shrub, not at all out of the ordinary. The problem was that they grew so quickly they stole sunlight from other ground plants, including young trees. They also had no natural predators. The local deer population ate everything but the mustard, leaving it free to colonize. It also produced a chemical that killed off bacteria in the soil that other plants needed for growth. A perfect botanical terror, in other words. Was my mother in the movement? Samuel said. Was she like a radical hippie or something? I was a radical hippie, Alice said. Your mother definitely was not. She was a normal kid. She was dragged into it against her will. Alice remembered her young, idealistic self. How she refused to own any possessions, refused to lock her door or carry money. Crazy behavior she wouldn't even consider now. What her younger self worried about were the hang-ups that came with possessions. The territoriality, the worry, the potential for loss, the way the world looked when you owned precious things. Like one big threat always ready to take your stuff. And yes, Alice had purchased this home in the Indiana Dunes. She filled it with her stuff. She put locks on all the doors. She built a wall of sandbags to contain the advance of the lake. She cleaned and sanded and painted, brought in exterminators and contractors and took down walls and erected new ones. And slowly this home came into being, bubbling up out of itself like Athena from the sea. And yes, it was true that all her former radical energies now poured into things like selecting the perfect pendant lamps or achieving the ideal kitchen workflow or constructing excellent built-in bookcases or finding the most calming master bedroom color palette that ideally involved the same blue the lake took on when she looked out her window certain winter mornings when the surface of the water was a slushy, shimmering mass that appeared, depending on the paint sample she used, like glacier blue, or liquid blue, or bluebell, or a really lovely gray-blue called sore. And yes, occasionally she felt bolts of raw guilt and regret that these were the hang-ups that interested her, not the peace and justice and equality movements she intended to devote her life to when she was 20. She decided that about 80% of what you believe about yourself when you're 20 turns out to be wrong. The problem is, you don't know what your small, true part is until much later. Who dragged her into it? Samuel said. Nobody, Alice said. Everybody. The events of the time. She got swept up. It was all terribly exciting, you see. For Alice, the small, true part of her was that she wanted something that deserved her faith and devotion. When she was young, she saw families retreat into their homes and ignore the greater problems of the world, and she hated them. Bourgeois cogs in the machine, unthinking sheep-like masses, selfish bastards who couldn't see beyond their own property lines. Their souls, she thought, must have been small and shrunken things. But then she grew up and bought a house and found a lover and got some dogs, and stewarded her land and tried to fill her home with love and life. And she realized her earlier error, that these things did not make you small. In fact, these things seemed to enlarge her. That by choosing a few very private concerns and pouring herself into them, she had never felt so expanded. That, paradoxically, narrowing her concerns had made her more capable of love and generosity and empathy and, yes, even peace and justice. It was the difference between loving something out of duty, because the movement required it of you, and loving something you actually loved. Love. Real, genuine, unasked-for love. Made room for more of itself, it turned out. Love, when freely given, duplicates and multiplies. Still, she could not help feeling stung when old movement friends said she had sold out. That was the worst of all charges, because of course it was true. But how could she explain that not all sellouts are the same? That it wasn't money she was selling out to? that sometimes on the other side of selling out, there's a compassion she'd never felt in her revolutionary days. She could not explain this to them, nor would they hear it. They still held to all the old principles, drugs, sex, resistance. Even as drugs began killing them one by one, and even as sex became dangerous, still this is where they turned for some kind of answer. They never saw how their resistance had begun to look comical. They were beaten by the cops and the public cheered. They thought they were changing the world, and what they did was help get Nixon elected. They found Vietnam intolerable, but their answer was to become intolerable themselves. The only thing less popular than the war in those days was the anti-war movement. This truth was obvious, though none of them saw it, convinced as they were of their own righteousness. She managed not to think about this too much, these ligatures to the past. For the most part, she thought about her dogs and mustard, except when something popped up to remind her of her former life, like, for example, the son of Faye Anderson coming to the dunes and asking questions. "Were you close?" he said, "with my mother. Were you friendly?" "I suppose," she said. "We didn't know each other very well." He nodded. He seemed disappointed by this. He was hoping for more, but what could Alice say? That Faye had indeed been on her mind all these years? That Faye's memory was a small but constant and needling companion? For that was the truth. She'd promised to look out for Faye, but things got out of hand, and she failed. She never knew what happened to her. She never saw her again. There is no greater ache than this, guilt and regret in equal measure. She'd tried to bury it along with all the other mistakes of her youth out here in the dunes, and she would not dig these stories up now, even for this man who so plainly needed them. The subject of his mother seemed like a splinter he could not remove. She grabbed a small bunch of mustard and pulled, not too hard and with a gentle spin to get the roots up. She had long ago perfected this technique. For a long, quiet moment they stayed like this, the only sounds being mustard plants tearing free from the earth and the whoosh of the nearby lake, and a certain bird whose call sounded like,
uh-uh.
"Even if you figure it all out," Alice said, "what good will it do?"
"What do you mean?"
"Even if you know your mom's story, it's not going to change anything. The past is the past."
"I guess I hope it'll explain something. About all the things she's done. Plus she's in trouble and maybe I can help. There's this judge who seems intent on putting her in jail. It's like he came out of retirement just to torment her. The Honorable Charlie Brown my ass."
Alice perked up at that. Lifted her gaze from the mustard. She placed her half-full trash bag on the ground. She removed her gloves, her specialized rubber gloves that mustard seeds did not stick to. She walked over to where Samuel stood, taking the big, awkward steps made necessary by her wading boots. "That's his name?" she said. "Charlie Brown?"
"Hilarious, right?"
"Oh, God," she said, sitting down right there in the grass.
"Oh, no."
"What?" Samuel said. "What's wrong?"
"Listen to me," Alice said. "You have to get your mother out of here."
"What do you mean?"
"She needs to leave."
"Now I'm sure there's something you're not telling me."
"I used to know him," she said. "The judge."
"Okay, and?"
"We were all sort of intertwined in Chicago, in college, me and the judge and your mom."
"That's information you maybe should have led with."
"You have to get your mom out of town, like, immediately."
"Tell me why."
"Maybe even get her out of the country."
"Help my mom flee the country. That's your advice."
"I wasn't entirely honest about why I moved out here, to Indiana. The real reason was because of him. When I heard he was back in Chicago, I moved away. I was afraid of him."
Samuel sat down with her in the grass, and they stared at each other a moment, shell-shocked.
"What did he do to you?" he asked.
"Your mom is in trouble," Alice said. "The judge will never yield. He's ruthless and dangerous. You have to take her away. Do you hear me?"
"I don't understand. What's his grudge against her?"
She sighed and looked at the ground.
"He's like the most dangerous species of American there is. Heterosexual white male who didn't get what he wanted."
"You need to tell me exactly
what happened, Samuel said.
About 3 feet past her left knee, she noticed a small and heretofore unseen patch of garlic mustard. First-year shoots, a smattering of clover hiding under the grass. It wouldn't go to seed until next summer, but when it did, it would race up above the surrounding plants and kill them all. "I have never told this story," she said. "Not to anyone."
"What happened in 1968?" Samuel said. "Please tell me."
Alice nodded. She ran her hands along the grass, and the thin blades tickled her palms. She made a mental note to come prune this spot tomorrow. The problem with mustard is that you can't just chop it down. The seeds can last for years. It will always come back. You have to cut it out completely. You have to cut it out by the roots.
Part 7. Circle. Late summer, 1968. 1.
Her own room. Her own key and mailbox. Her own books. Everything was hers but the bathroom. Faye hadn't considered this. The dorm's clinical, foul-smelling community bathroom. Stale water, dirty floors, sinks strewn with hair, trash cans thick with tissues and tampons and balled-up brown paper towels, a smell like slow decay that reminded her of a forest. Faye imagined, beneath the floor, earthworms and mushrooms, how the bathroom bore the evidence of so much appalling use. Soap slivers now fused to their trays, fossils. The one toilet that's always plugged. The slime on the walls like a brain where the memory of each girl's cleaning lived. She thought if you looked deep enough into the floor, you could find there, embalmed in the pink tiles, the whole history of the world. Bacteria, fungus, nematodes, trilobites. A dormitory was a hopeless idea. Whoever thought of encasing 200 girls in a concrete box? The narrow rooms, shared bath, massive cafeteria. The comparison to prison was unavoidable. It was a dark and creepy bunker, their dorm. From the outside, its concrete skeleton looked like some martyr's flayed chest. All you could see were the ribs. All the buildings on Circle's campus looked this way. Inside out. Exposed. Sometimes walking to class, she ran her fingers along the walls where the concrete resembled acne, and she felt embarrassed for the buildings, how an eccentric designer had taken their guts and put them on view. A perfect metaphor, she thought, for dormitory living. Take this bathroom, where all the girls' private fluids commingled, the big open shower with sour puddles of water like gray jelly, a vegetable smell. Faye wore sandals, and if her neighbors were awake, they would know it was Faye walking down the hall by the flop, flop, flop. But they weren't awake. It was 6 o'clock in the morning. Faye had the bathroom to herself. She could shower alone. She preferred it this way. Because she didn't want to be here with the other girls, her neighbors, who gathered nightly in their small rooms and giggled, got high, talked about the protest, the police, the pipes they passed to smoke with, the medicines they expanded their minds with, the electric songs they screeched along with. Looks like everybody in this whole round world, they're down on me. They cried to the record player like it bled from them. Faye heard their wails through her wall, a litany to a terrible god. It seemed disallowable that these girls could really be her neighbors, freaky beatniks. Psychedelic revolutionaries who needed to learn to clean up after themselves in the bathroom, was Faye's opinion, looking at a glob of tissue near the wall, now mostly liquefied. She took off her robe and turned on the spray and waited for the water to warm. Every night the girls laughed and Faye listened. She wondered what made the girls able to sing so unselfconsciously. Faye didn't talk to them and looked at the floor when they passed by. They chewed on their pencils in class and complained about the teacher, how he only taught the old straight shit. Plato, they said, Ovid, Dante. Dead men assholes with nothing to say to today's youth. That's how they said it, today's youth. As if college students these days were a brand new species, totally disconnected from the past and from the culture that spawned them.
And as far as Faye could tell, the rest of the culture pretty much agreed. Older adults complained about them endlessly on CBS News' nightly examinations of the generation gap. Faye stepped into the warm water and let it soak her. One hole in the shower nozzle was clogged and sprayed out thinner and harder than the rest. She felt it like a razor on her chest. In these first days of college, Faye mostly kept to herself. Each night she sat alone and did her homework, underlining key passages, writing notes in the margins, and next door she heard these girls laughing. The college brochures had said nothing about this. Circle was supposed to be known for its expectation of excellence, its academic rigor, its modern campus. None of this turned out to be exactly true. The campus especially was just an inhuman concrete horror. Concrete buildings and concrete walkways and concrete walls that made the place about as comfortable and inviting as a parking lot. No grass anywhere. Concrete edifices scarred and ribbed to evoke the look of corduroy, perhaps, or the inside of a whale. Concrete bitten off in places to expose raw and rusted rebar. The same basic architectural patterns endlessly repeating in a faceless grid. No windows wider than a few inches. Bulky buildings that seemed to hang over the students carnivorously. It was the kind of place that would be the only place to survive an atom bomb. The campus was impossible to navigate, as every building looked like every other building, and so directions were confused and meaningless. The elevated second-story pedestrian walkway that covered the entire campus and sounded so cool in the brochures, a pedestrian expressway in the sky, was in reality maybe the most horrible thing about Circle. It was advertised as a place for students to come together for community and friendship, but what usually happened is you were up on the walkway and saw a friend down below, and you yelled and waved but had no easy way to actually talk. Faye noticed this daily, friends waving and then sadly abandoning each other. Plus, the walkway was never the shortest path from anywhere to anywhere, and the places to get on and off were spaced such that the length of your walk doubled if you wanted to use it. And the midday August sun had a tendency to cook the concrete expanse to the heat of a pancake griddle. So most of the students used the sidewalks below, the whole student body trying to shoulder their way through narrow corridors made crowded and claustrophobic by the big concrete posts needed to hold up the walkway, all of it dark and shadowy because the walkway blocked the sun. A rumor that the Circle campus had been designed by the Pentagon to instill terror and despair among students could not be entirely dismissed. Faye had been promised a campus fit for the space age, but what she got was a place where every building's surface evoked the gravel roads from back home. She'd been promised a hard-working and studious student body, and what she got instead were these neighbors next door, these girls less interested in academics, more interested in how to score dope, how to sneak into bars, get free drinks, how to screw, and they talked about this endlessly, one of their two favorite topics, the other being the protest. The upcoming protest of the Democratic National Convention, now only a few weeks away. A great battle would happen in Chicago, it was becoming clear, the year's apotheosis. The girls talked excitedly about their plans, an all-female march right down Lakeshore Drive, a protest in the form of music and love, 4 days of revolution, orgies in the park, the perfect silvery human voice in song, we'll touch the honky young, bring down the amphitheater show, shove a great spike in America's eye, we'll take back the streets and all those people watching on TV, we're gonna anti-America them, man. With all that energy, we'll stop the war. Faye felt far away from such concerns. She soaped herself, her chest and arms and legs thickly. The lather made her feel like a ghost or mummy or some other generally white and scary thing. The water in Chicago was different from the water at home, and no matter how much she rinsed, the soap never came entirely off. A thin varnish lingered on her skin. How easily and smoothly her hands glided over her hips and legs and thighs. She closed her eyes, thought of Henry. His hands on her body as they lay on the riverbank her last night in Iowa. They were cold and hard, those hands, and when he reached under her shirt and pressed them to her belly, it was like they were stones from the bottom of the riverbed. She gasped. He stopped. She didn't want him to stop, but she couldn't tell him without sounding unladylike. and he hated when she was unladylike. He gave her an envelope that night with instructions not to open it until she got to college. Inside was a letter. She had been fearing another poem, but what she found was a little couplet that knocked her over. "Come home, marry me." Meanwhile, he'd joined the army, just as he said he would. He had promised to go to Vietnam, but had gotten only as far as Nebraska. He did riot control exercises in preparation for whatever civil disorder was inevitably next. He practiced sticking his bayonet into dummies filled with sand and dressed like hippies. He practiced using tear gas. He practiced phalanxing. They would be seeing each other again at Thanksgiving, and Faye dreaded it, because she had no answer to his proposal. She had read his letter once and hidden it like contraband. But she did look forward to meeting again on the riverbank when they were alone, and he could try touching her again. She had found herself thinking about it these desolate mornings in the shower, pretending her hands were someone else's. Maybe Henry's. Maybe more accurately, the hands of some abstract man. In her imagination, she could not see him, but instead felt his presence, a solid masculine warmth pressing into her. She thought about this as she felt the soap on her body, the slippery water, the smell of the shampoo as she rubbed it into her hair. She turned around to wash it out and opened her eyes and saw, across the room, standing at the sink, watching her right now, a girl. "Excuse me," Faye yelped. For it was one of those girls. Alice was her name. Faye's neighbor, long-haired, mean-looking Alice. Silver-framed sunglasses settled halfway down her nose, so at this moment she stared over them directly and curiously and terribly at Faye. "Excuse you for what?" Alice said. Faye shut off the water and wrapped herself in her robe. "Man," Alice said, smiling, "you are too much." She was the craziest of them all, this Alice. Green camo jacket and black boots, wild brunette Buddha girl.